Welcome back to The Present Stage, Conversations with Theater Writers. My name is Dan Rubens, and I'm a theater critic, a composer, and an arts nonprofit leader. My guest today is Angelica Sherry, the lyricist and book writer of Gun and Powder, which is currently playing at the Paper Mill Playhouse in Millburn, New Jersey, through May 5th. Earlier this season, I interviewed Kate Kerrigan, the book writer of another Paper Mill premiere, the musical adaptation of The Great Gatsby. You can check out that episode after you listen to this one from late 2023. That musical, The Great Gatsby, opened on Broadway last night, April 25th. So hopefully lightning will strike twice for the Paper Mill guests who come on the podcast. And it was really lovely to get to speak to Angelica Sherry about her work adapting a family legend, family lore, into a musical, and really appreciate her diving so deeply into the developmental process. A lot of fun to get to learn about how the show evolved over the past decade to where it is now. So without further ado, here's Angelica Sherry talking about her musical, Gun and Powder. Angelica Sherry, welcome to The Present Stage.
Hi, good to be here.
So wonderful to have you here. I wanted to start by asking you, I know that Gun and Powder comes from your own family's history and lore, and I can imagine that sharing the storytelling responsibilities here with collaborators, both your composer and then as the team has grown from there, takes probably even more trust than other kinds of ideas and other kinds of stories, because it's your own family, and this is a show that is about family and blood to such a really deep degree. And I'm curious to start out by asking you, sort of, what did it take for you to sort of have that trust to sort of share this the responsibility of telling your family story with collaborators?
Well, thank you for that. I love that. That's such a great question. What's been really fun about this particular family story is that it's so fabled. There's so many different competing narratives in my family about what really happened that it's clear no one really knows. Really, it's just like, okay, if I deduce from my grandma, my uncle, this cousin, this aunt, there's just some sort of a wash, but not real narrative that I have to be so religiously precious about. And so that just opened it up to be whatever story we wanted to tell. And I think that that's what made it so easy to just trust that people know what the intention and what the heart and the message of the story is. And that's what's most important, rather than there being facts that we have to remain exact about. So that was easy. That made it a lot easier.
Right. And I'm wondering in particular, your composer, Ross Baum, if you want to talk about sort of how you came to meet each other and sort of how that collaboration came to be.
Yeah, I mean, so Ross and I met at NYU in the Graduate Musical Theater Writing Program. And we were partnered together earlier in the year for an assignment. And then we decided to become thesis partners. And when we were having initial conversations about what we wanted to write about, I pitched him the story of Mary and Martha, and he was sold. He was immediately locked in, and we just sort of knew almost immediately that that's the story that we wanted to write. And it's just been such an awesome collaborator. He's become one of my best friends in the world, and it's just, and I love his storytelling instincts, and he's a musical genius. And so it's just, it's been a great marriage of the meeting of the minds for this story and beyond.
And at the time that you sort of pitched this idea, had you already started, how long had it been sort of germinating as like this family lore, this family legend is something that that I want to dramatize, that I want to musicalize?
It's so funny because I really started, it wasn't something that I was thinking about until maybe a year prior, because we knew the Graduate Musical Theater Writing MFA program at NYU is a 2-year program. It's like speed dating between music, theater writers, composers, and lyricists. And so we knew that in the second year, we were going to be tasked to write a thesis musical. And so one of the things that happened our late great Sarah Schlesinger, who was the head of the program at the time, she was instilling in us this idea of where do these musicals come from? Where do ideas for musicals come from? And we took a class called Source Material, where we learned about the different places that you can derive material for a musical. And so in that class, we talked about historical figures. And I think that that just stuck with me. I mean, we talked about lots of things. We talked about found text, we talked about personal narratives, but then we also talked about historical figures. And that was just really resonant for me because, for one, I love history. I'm a history buff. And then also, I was thinking about, excuse me, what sort of historical figures that I'm always drawn to. And for me, it's always Black women. And I was thinking about what sort of musical I would want to write, and which Black women would I want to highlight. And of course, we think about people who are incredible, like Sojourner Truth, Ida B. Wells, and of course they're all incredible Black women, incredible historical figures who deserve to have stories written about them. But then my mind just wandered back to that photo album that I would see as a child, and the portraits of Mary and Martha Clark, and thinking, but I've got my own historical figures in my family, these mysterious, austere women who pass for white, and the family is just intrigued by them and their story about being outlaws. Like, that's fun. There's so much mystery and intrigue there that it's like begging for a story to be made up of. There's already stories made up about them. So, like, why not just mine that? So it was like a natural gift from my family.
And can you talk about sort of how you balanced? Presumably, there was a lot of historical research that went in to crafting the book and lyrics of the show, but also sort of taking these family lore, various versions of the story that had sort of been passed down to you. How did you kind of strike the balance between something that felt historically plausible, but also really rooted in what you sort of introduced from the very beginning of something that feels structured like a story that's been passed down and changed and transformed through the generations?
For sure. So the research that we did was mostly centered on understanding what the landscape was of the Wild Wild West. So what was happening? We learned about the cowboys of the time, the big bad. Oh my goodness, the names are escaping me right now. But like those legendary outlaws, from the male perspective and the female perspective, like what was that culture like? What was outlaw culture? What did it mean to come into these saloon towns? What did it mean to be an outlaw, to be on the run? These wanted posters. Like, we wanted to have a landscape of that. We wanted to know what was happening in Texas at the time. It was a very interesting time historically because we're post-emancipation, like just one generation post-emancipation. So that was a factor. And then the climate of Texas, but the climate of the discovery of the West and what that was happening, the uncovering of the West and that sort of culture. So that was really what rooted us in the town and in how we started in Marlin, Texas, where my family is actually from. And we wanted to know what was happening in Marlin and what was happening in the bigger cities. And so we gathered as much as we wanted to, but we never felt like we had to just this is not a history lesson. It's not a history report, right? We want this to serve the story that we want to tell about these two women. And so we learned about miscegenation, also the interracial couples, and how that was something that how what in terms of the crime of passing for white, and then the crime of interracial marriage, which is absurd to think about, right? But like, what did all those things mean? What were the consequences? What were the stakes? So all of that just helped us to build up the story and gave us those anchor points of like, okay, remember how dangerous this is. Remember how much fun we want to have telling the story. And let's not forget that this was a life and death situation, sharecropping, debt, and crime. And just the meeting of it all just became a delicious exploration that we were having so much fun telling our favorite version of.
And I'm curious, when you talk about sort of the Wild Wild West outlaw side of it, how much of it, how did you find, kind of approach the balance of having it be a genre piece that it does have this sort of Western outlaw feel, and sort of you have like montages of holdups, but then also has a very different sort of thematic through line that is not sort of the genre per se. How do you think about how much you wanted it to feel like, oh, this is a familiar mode of story throughout, so audiences could say, oh, there's a recognizable Western tale with all of these other layers.
I love this question. It's so interesting. If we think about it as like a puzzle, we knew that if we're doing the Wild Wild West, we have to have bank robberies. We have to have a train sequence. We've got to have a train hold up. There's got to be holdups. We've got to have a saloon. There's got to be a saloon action, all those different things, right? And so we were thinking about how we wanted to incorporate all of that. We wanted to see the women being outlaws. We wanted to see them taking control, kicking butt, taking names, stealing money, having their retribution, having their reparations. We wanted to see that because the core of this story is about the family. It's about Mary and Martha and their mother, Tallulah, and what she means to them and how they navigate exploring these different aspects of their identity when it's not given to them, when they're not prescribed by this person. By the oppression of being on the cotton fields every day, working in the fields, being told who they are and what they're supposed to do, what happens when they get to step away. And so that becomes a very human story about who we are and who society tells us that we are, how we navigate multiple areas of our identity, how two things that should not, quote unquote, according to society standards, exist in the same person, but they exist in you. And what does that mean? So we really rooted ourselves in the identity piece of it, the family piece of it, and the love stories, because those are also major parts of the story. But we did not feel, we felt like the structure of a Western or the structure of a Journey in Return, which is kind of what this story has lent itself to be, like a Wizard of Oz, Alice in Wonderland. You leave Kansas, you go to Oz, and you come back to Kansas at the end. We looked at all those structures, and we looked at all of those. We looked at the high noon shootouts and what the pieces of a quintessential Western were. And we knew that we already were not going to be married to what the traditional structures were, because we're telling a story about two Black women. Black women were very rarely ever, if ever, depicted in the traditional Westerns of like the John Waynes, Spaghetti Westerns, all those, good, bad, and the ugly. So we thought, great, like we need to just, again, like about taking these things that are prescribed and that have been like tried and true, and using that to our disposal how we want to, or how, as much or as little as we want it to.
You alluded to sort of the also telling these stories of these romances, these pairs of romances in the show. And I'm curious to ask you more about specifically Mary's relationship and marriage with Jesse, who sort of becomes the villain of the piece. She has a song, Real Woman, which is sort of this sort of jubilant number where she's really discovering for the first time that she could actually live as a white woman and marry this man. And she seems genuinely happy, and the audience is sort of invited to share in the happiness, which is sort of represented through this sort of jubilant, impressive, virtuosic performance. But also at the same time, the what she's really saying in this lyric about, she says, I'll be real and everything in my past will be erased. So we know as an audience, and maybe this is also a different question later on, but we know as an audience that that's not a path that we're rooting for her. And we want her to be happy, but that doesn't seem, but we know that that at least is not what the show doesn't want us to feel, that that is the way for her to achieve happiness. So I wonder sort of how you approach a lyric like that, where you want the actor to perform that jubilation and you want the audience to feel that, but also have an awareness of what that happiness means in that context.
I love this question so much. And I thank you for asking it, because that's exactly You hit it exactly on the on you hit the nail on the head. We were so it's so interesting. So of the songs, there's like about 25 songs in the show, and it's been I think about 110 songs have been written over the years for this show. It's been 10 years in the making, and there's about seven from the original thesis at NYU that remain. And Real Woman is one of those seven, but it used to be called Real Man. And it was all about Jesse and how he was a real man, like she had never experienced before. But we realized that that wasn't the right way forward because what we really wanted to tell with that song was we wanted to walk Mary through the realization of what it would mean to marry a white man and essentially be passing for the rest of her life. And because that was always a question of what at what point does Mary make that massive shift? She's an outlaw and she's very much on board with Martha through the most of the first act, the first half of the first act, and then the sharp turn with Jesse just kind of just catapults things in a completely different direction. And why is that? What happened? And so Real Woman is that spot where we really get to sit in Mary's psyche as a woman who has been living her whole life in oppression and all the things that she's never gotten to enjoy, she's never gotten to experience, that's never been acknowledged, that her needs, wants, desires, and which are all just basic human needs, basic human wants, basic human aspirations. She's not asking for the moon and the stars. Like she's thinking about having a bed to sleep in that wasn't made out of a straw mattress, right? And so the calculation that's happening in Real Woman is Mary is walking through discovering the idea that it's one thing to be an outlaw. It's one thing to rob people and steal things and have that sort of thrill. But that it's another thing to marry a white man, to marry her identity to his and everything that he is able to afford her. And that just gets absorbed. Her former identity gets dismissed, and this gets repl it replaces all of that. And it is a very dark and scary and sad I would say trade-off or exchange that Mary makes, but she doesn't see it that way. She sees it as a jubilant, as you described, and beautiful and wonderful and almost heavenly opportunity. She's excited for that. And so the song, the music displays how she feels about it. And the words are talking through the actual reality of her parsing through, and it's dark and it's tragic. And so it is possible to listen to Real Woman and just clap and bob your head and have a good time and not really register the darkness and the depth of what she's saying, which we were excited about. We were excited about giving the character an opportunity to lure us into being into seeing her psychology and seeing the way she's seeing and calculating the choice, but also understand she doesn't see anything wrong with this. She thinks.
Right. Another sort of character sort of tension in the play I'm curious about is Jesse, who I'm curious just how you approached writing that character so that he would both seem like a viable choice for a protagonist to pursue. So the audience doesn't feel like she's just crazy. Without sort of avoiding the sort of like cartoonish mustache twirling Western villain tropes. But also then having sort of later in the show these darker revelations about who he is and what he represents and all of that. I'm curious how I'm especially if that character has evolved over the course of the years that you've worked on it.
Sure. So what's interesting about Jesse is that we've always wanted him to be someone who Mary, who we could believe Mary would fall in love with. We never wanted to feel like Mary was not justified in what she wanted because she is. And we also, especially Case in point with Mary and Martha, who are half black, half white, we are showing humanity can exist and two things that seemingly are opposite can exist in one person at one time. Two things can be true at the same time. And that's true of Jesse as well. It's true that Jesse is a wealthy, loving, charming, well-dressed, poised man who truly loves Mary and who would provide a wonderful life for her. And he also has a deep past rooted in slave labor and his privilege and his perceptions of blackness and his perceptions of who he is in the world and what that should look like. And it's terrifying to have not experienced that side of him, married him already, and then find this out in the later half of the play. But that's exactly the exchange that we're showing. This is what Mary is married to now. And it's important that he's not a villain because, I mean, that he's not a cartoonish villain because it's not true of humanity. It's true of humanity to be a wonderful person, but to have deep, dark secrets and to have complexities and things and frayed edges. And so we just wanted all the characters, but Jesse especially, to be believably human.
Another number I'm curious about, sort of the evolution of, is the song "Just Passing Through," which takes place as the sisters are first traveling from Marlin, and it's a number where they're trying to make sense of the white passengers' dialogue and conversations, and then try to sort of for the first time pass not only visually but also in interacting. And you have this sort of half impenetrable language sort of representing their conversation. And then also you have the wordplay of like of just passing through with the double meaning of passing, which I think comes back later in the show as well. And I'm curious just sort of how that moment evolved, because I think both in terms of sort of a turning point where they're sort of entering that world for the first time, and also in the way in sort of introducing a way that you might tell the story or sort of heighten the reality. I'm curious whether that from the beginning you were like, oh, that's what that moment's going to look like and sound like, or when you sort of discovered that.
Yeah, Just Passing Through came sort of midway through the journey of the show. I want to say that was the song that was born around the time that we were doing the SigWorks lab at the Signature Theater in Arlington. So probably around 2017. But that was something because there was always the question of the obligatory moment, which is how do the women learn how to pass? How do they learn how to physically and verbally pass and integrate and assimilate, quote unquote, into this white world that they've never had access to before. And so what we wanted to do, there were so many questions because we've had multiple workshops and readings, and there's just been so much development over the years for the show. And one of the questions that we would get often would be, well, once they get to Houston, once they get into Sweet Christine, once they're around more white people, should they change the way that they talk? Should they change this about their movements? Should they change this and change that? And we did not want that to be something that was threaded throughout the entire show, because then that would become what the show was about and it would feel very unnatural and just a distraction. But so we thought it would be best to use that as. Use to craft a number in which all that happens, and we see that journey happening. And Just Passing Through is the first time that they're in scene with white actors, with white characters, aside from Mr. Billingsley, but when they are in the white space, it's their first time there. And it is also intentional that it is on the train because it is their method of transportation, not just from Marlin to Sweet Christine and Houston and wherever else that they go, but it is also their transportation from one identity into the next. And so our brilliant choreographer, Tiffany Rhea Fisher, who, excuse me, was newer to the team. She's been with us since our workshop in the fall of last year. She's conceived of such an awesome tapestry of what the posturing, the different ways of movement and taking in space and weaving with that community, how that looks physically. And that has done a tremendous amount of storytelling for us, in addition to Ross's genius of taking the cords from cotton at home, but using them in a different manner. And that is the musical foundation for Just Passing Through. And lyrically, we, as you said, imagining what the girls are hearing, imagining what Mary and Martha are hearing, if they're hearing people speak in this way for the first time, it's some of it you're not going to be able to pick up. Like it's like when you're overhearing a conversation, you can't understand everything that they're saying, but you just hear little words pop up. That's why it's something, something tea, something honeybee. And it's like, oh, okay, I think I'm getting what they're saying, getting the gist of it, but it's not all computing. And so we just wanted to marry the physical, the sonic, the verbal worlds to just show they are not in Kansas anymore. And they have to figure out how to navigate through this new world.
One of my favorite elements of the show is the kinfolk community of narrators, both because it's as a way to start the show is such a really specific way to introduce the way that you're going to tell this story, and also just knowing that it actually is a story that comes from your own family, it feels really tied to sort of the genesis of the piece feels really tied to the way that you're telling the story in a way that seems really special. So I wonder, I was just curious sort of where that structure came from, if there are other theater pieces that inspired you in that way, or sort of how that those moments evolved as well.
Oh, the kinfolk. We love the kinfolk. And the kinfolk to us, that they represent the way the story, of course, there's a, in terms of theatrical devices, they are our Greek chorus, but it's also an ode to my family members because I've always been told the story of Mary and Martha Clark from elders in my family. Sitting around the dinner table looking at the photo album, and then the story happens. And so they are the family members sitting around the dinner table, spilling the tea and hearing the story, and telling their versions of it. And so that's and we have utilized them in and out of scene because they transform into other characters when necessary, but then they are always directly our proxy and our storytellers. I'm really, really inspired by one of my favorite musicals is is Sweeney Todd. And so and I just adore the Ballad of Sweeney Todd every time it comes around, and know that there's it makes something feel it makes a character feel legendary when other characters are speaking about them before they enter the stage. And speaking about them in ways that, and giving us information that we don't know, or connecting the dots and things like that, it just makes the show feel bigger when there's people singing about who the main characters are. And so that's exactly what we wanted with the kinfolk. It helps feed into this legend of Mary and Martha Clark.
And I'm wondering if there are other musicals or other theater works that influenced your either particular moments in the show or sort of stylistically. I'm curious what sort of your other musical theater influences might have been here.
I mean, for it's really Sweeney Todd. I mean, I'd have to really think about some of the other shows, but definitely because, the Attend the Tale of Sweeney Todd,
No, totally.
make way for the sisters Clark. Like it's kind of, it's really that would be the parallel. I mean, and we love Sondheim. So yeah.
Another sort of device that always is sort of like my musical theater nerd obsession is diegetic music, or for folks who are listening who don't know the term, examples of song that happen within the world of the show. So in this case, you have a saloon number that's performed by a performer in the saloon, and the song is called Frenchman Father, and sort of echoes loosely the story of the parents of Mary and Martha. And I'm wondering, sort of how you thought about building that song in, and why sort of having a diegetic number there felt like a good fit for sort of introducing the character of Jesse, and also that space and world, and how you thought about that.
So the funny thing about Frenchman Father, it is a little bit haunting how what happened with Frenchman Father. It was initially just conceived of as, so we have a saloon, which was something else we talked about, obligatory moment in a Western. We have to have a saloon moment. And the saloon's got to be raucous. It's got to be gritty. It's got to be dirty, but sexy and fun and beautiful and glamorous, all the different things. And so we thought, okay, how about we have this saloon singer and we sing the story of Mary and Martha Clarke's parents, what happened with the father. That was some information that is like alluded to by the kinfolk in the beginning, in the prologue. And Tallulah has strong feelings to express about it when she's, you know, when we get to scenes with her before the sisters leave. But there's also intrigue about, well, what happened? What was that story? What really happened with with their father? And so Frenchman Father was a way to express that in a way that felt active and not just expositional. But we also wanted Mary and Martha to be participants in that number, at least just as you said, the diegetic. They hear the song, they hear the words, and because it is their introduction into Sweet Christine and into Jesse Whitewater, this is someone, this was the job, this was the hoax, this was the big thing that they couldn't pull off right away. This is that lets them know, we see you. You're not, don't get too comfortable here, basically. Like there's more, this place is more aware, and this place is, there's something heightened about this place that's different from everywhere else that you've been. And so that was our intention with the song. What was crazy and haunting about it is that, so we wrote that song in a retreat, the Barnett, up in upstate New York, in 2018. And prior to that, I had not been aware, I did not know the story of Bill Clark, William Clark, who was the real father of Mary and Martha Clark, my great 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 grandfather. And he was the product of a, we don't know if it was a love affair, if it was consensual, or if it was not consensual, but between an enslaved woman named Molly and a Frenchman with a very long, he has about five names. And so their grandfather was a Frenchman, an actual Frenchman. And when I found this out, like right when Ross and I had returned from the writing retreat, and it just sort of stunned me. Like, we wrote this fictional song, but it's actually the real story of their grandfather. So it was a bit chilling. And there are other moments like that in the history of the show that have happened just in that same type of way. But if it's an act, it's an accurate depiction of their history.
Wow. I wonder if you could highlight, remind me, what year did you start developing the show?
2014.
So over the past decade, I'm wondering if you could highlight a couple of the moments of sort of greatest discovery for you, whether that was at a workshop or a reading or whatever developmental moment where you realize like, oh, this is what we've been doing wrong, or this is the way we need to fix it. And sort of were there moments that you're like, oh, thank God we figured that out in this moment, because that changes a huge thing for us.
Oh, so many. The first thing that comes to mind in the be in so very early on, 2015. So we graduated from NYU's Graduate Musical Theater Writing Program in 2015. And that was May 2015. So we're almost going on 9 years to date. But so when we that fall, we were invited to have a workshop production of the show with students from the New Studio on Broadway, which are the acting in the musical theater acting singing students, undergraduate students at NYU. And when we had that production, and that was directed by Jerry Dixon, we the second act was completely different because there was a crime that was committed at the end of there was someone who was killed at the end of the first act. And the second act was all about blaming that killing on the character Elijah, Martha's love interest, and the manhunt for him, and all of those different things, and how that converged. And we realized that that was just the wrong way to go. We just felt like everything was just focusing on, he did it. We have to find him. We've got to kill him. We've got to do this. We've got to get that, do that, get away, come with me, all those different things. And so we realized that that was not really serving us in the way that we wanted to or needed it to. So we really took a giant step backwards, or just a, not backwards, rather, which is a giant pause. And we completely reconceived of the show, specifically the second act and lots of things in the first, but specifically the second act and what happens between Mary and Jesse. That was big. Another massive moment for us was deciding that we needed to have the kinfolk as narrators. We'd had some semblance of it in the early drafts. We called it Clark Blood, and they were a little bit more spiritual, ephemeral. They weren't physically present in scenes, and they weren't necessarily forthcoming with information as narrators. But we landed on this idea of the kinfolk. I want to say that was somewhere in the 2018 space, 2019 space of the show, where we realized, yeah, we need them not only to help us tell pieces of the story and piece things together and move things along, but we also need them in order to just clarify, this is a legend, this is a family lore. We are telling you this story, passing along that folktale. And so those are two of the biggest. I'm sure there's like a ton more, but like off the top of my head, those are the two biggest things that I can remember.
I am also curious from this paper mill production, which is still in progress as we're still running as we're talking. I'm wondering if you've discovered things through this process that you want to continue to work on or continue to develop, wherever the show goes from here.
Sure. I mean, there are smaller things, like little surgical things that, and sometimes I can be so insistent on picking at lyrics. I'm like, oh, we have to change that one word, change that. So that's been, those are, there's a collection of those things like that, definitely. The bigger picture things, we're still marinating on stuff, but for the most part, it's still cooking, so we'll see.
And I wanted to close by asking you, because you talked about sort of receiving this story from the elders in your family, and I wonder if you could talk to any specific responses from your family members to seeing the show, and what it's meant for your family to see your family story told in this way.
The biggest reaction, I mean, for me, the most moving was watching my father see the show at Paper Mill. And I've had family members come both to Paper Mill and to the Signature prior in 2020. But the overall sentiment is just like, number one, like, wow, we never imagined that the story of Mary and Martha Clark would become this big and this massive and this detailed and intricate. It's just wilder and bigger and fuller than what the family has imagined, because again, it's been just fragments of things. But then also, it's the sentiment has been like, you did something with this story. Somebody did something with the sisters, Mary and Martha, the Amazonian. The family knows them to be, there's a lot of talk about them being Amazon women because of how tall they were. They were like massive, like almost 6 feet tall. And just they had big presence. And so it's just it feels, the overall feeling that I get is just this sense of pride, like, yes, someone for our story, for our women. So I couldn't be more honored by that.
Yeah, well, I think that's a wonderful note to end on, and congratulations on this run and whatever is to come, and thank you so much for joining the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun.
Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of The Present Stage with Angelica Sherry. If you liked what you heard today, please share with a friend, please share with a family member, maybe suggest musicalizing one of your ancestors' stories. You can follow us on Instagram at The Present Stage. You can subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can leave a 5-star rating or a review, all that good stuff. The Broadway season 2023-2024 is officially over, so we have some really exciting folks coming on soon to talk about some of the Broadway shows that are now open and running. So really excited to share all of that with you in the coming weeks. In the meantime, keep listening to The Present Stage and keep enjoying theater.